This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Dispatches from the 16th International AIDS Conference, a CKUT 90.3 FM production, with reporting by Janice Dale and production by Shiraz Janjua.
Between August 13 and 18, 2006, it seemed like the world descended on Toronto for the 16th International AIDS Conference and its overarching theme, Time to Deliver.
Our response is microscopic. We are inviting the whirlwind, and we will not be able to cope.
Even with expanding the prevention options, there is no silver bullet.
The media, and the black media in particular, has particularly marginalized our communities.
It feels as though we may have found articulated at this conference a potential turning point. We may look back on it as an important moment.
Initially a biannual scientific conference, the International AIDS Conference has grown to an Olympic-sized event, spawning the wide gamut of issues pertinent to HIV/AIDS and the world's quest to not only stem its spread, but also effectively address the consequences of its reality. And so the immense meeting of minds focused on issues like access to treatment, vaccine and microbicide development, stigma and discrimination, launching of the Global Youth Coalition on HIV/AIDS, and concrete proposals to initiate the first ever African Black Diasporic HIV/AIDS Global Network. Winston Husbands of the African Caribbean Council on HIV/AIDS, Ontario.
I am one of the co-chairs. The African and Caribbean Council on HIV and AIDS in Ontario has, it's a coalition really of organizations and service providers, researchers and policymakers. We have two co-chairs and I am one of the co-chairs.
Winston, Bill Gates mentioned in the conference that the fight against HIV/AIDS may prove unsuccessful if we continue fragmentation. So people of the African diaspora have come together and decided to form a global network. What priorities do you think the global network will identify?
The first thing that we have to do is to create some kind of infrastructure to make this possible, to develop it and start to grow it. And that infrastructure will have to recognize our diversity and so on. And it will have to involve people who are dedicated, who have the time and energy to help us make those initial steps. But, you know, this is something that we think is very important because we need, whether we're in Canada, you know, whether we're in the U.S., whether we're in the European countries, we need to be able to share information, to share ideas, to share strategies. And we also need to be able to advocate globally, internationally, on behalf of our communities. And the only way we can do this is if we have this global network.
Richard Brzezinski of the International Council of AIDS Service Organizations, ICASO.
So as we go forward in globalization and the challenges faced by the world getting smaller, we realize that the focus of how we interact with each other and get our agendas on a very crowded agenda, how important it is to have networks understanding how they can do this and to learn from each other. And particularly, you know, the focus that this stream has provided throughout the conference. It's the first time they've had this diaspora stream presented at an international conference to bring together the various interests to really see how they can work together. As we go forward working on HIV and AIDS, there's a couple of key critical issues that we have to be aware of. The first one is scaling up. We talk about developing countries and we talk about the industrialized and developing, but what we all have to realize is irrespective of whether you're north, south, east or west, we are all going to have to scale up the response to HIV and AIDS. Prevention is failing us in the north, it's failing us in the south and in the east and in the west for a whole variety of different reasons. So as community organizations getting together, the one and the first lesson we know is we have to be smarter. And we become smarter by learning from each other. And that's one of the key issues around networking and creating a more formal structure to continue the work after this particular conference. ICASA was born at an international conference of AIDS service organizations, a fairly broad topic, in 1989 at the Montreal conference. And the reason why was, number one, to ensure that the voices of those that we worked with were better represented in the conference. The issues that those voices were struggling with to be better represented in the conference, and to ensure that there was both representation and a whole variety of other issues related to how do we interact with each other as AIDS organizations. And clearly the place we are now in history is that, you know, there are subgroups and different types of networks now emerging, because you need to be able to articulate an agenda with policymakers that start to meet your needs. And clearly there are a lot of needs that aren't being met. And as we move towards scaling up, we have to ensure that those communities most vulnerable and affected by HIV and AIDS have their agenda with policymakers. And to have strong and articulate representation means that we can often learn from each other to see how best to do it.
George Campango of the Malawi Network for People Living with HIV AIDS, MANE Plus.
People must understand what HIV and AIDS is and what the implications are. Yeah, and to achieve that, we went into advocacy activities with the traditional leaders, went into advocacy activities with district authorities, like the district commissioners. Because in Malawi, we have structures at district level, the district AIDS coordinating committees. We advocated for the inclusion of people living with HIV and AIDS permanently on those committees. And that is being implemented. And so people living with HIV and AIDS are able to plan, to implement, to monitor and evaluate HIV AIDS related work at district level. And by district level, I mean that the local communities access the information that they need to have. As a result, prevention efforts are available, are being taken into account and consideration, as well as care and support efforts. We have home-based care, we have orphan care. In Malawi, the problem of orphan care.
Is it a large problem there? There are many orphans?
It is. The number of orphans has increased, and it's well over 500,000 orphans due to AIDS.
By the end of 2005, UNAIDS reported 40.3 million people were living with HIV/AIDS in the world. Rooted in issues surrounding social and gender inequality, HIV/AIDS has wreaked havoc on the lives of millions of children. Of the 40.3 million known infections globally, 17.5 million are in women and 2.3 million in children. Children and young people are the most vulnerable to this epidemic, with an estimated 15 million children having lost one or both parents to HIV/AIDS in 2004. According to UNAIDS, the vast majority of these children are based in Africa. In the Global Village, I met John Kirkwood from Uganda's Tofta Educational Trust, who spoke about his initiative to provide education for Uganda's orphans.
This is a UK-based charity, and it provides education for 180 orphan children, because there's no free secondary education in either Kenya or Uganda. So when there are no school fees, the kid has to drop out of school. We currently have 180 kids on our books. We're looking to increase the number, because Uganda has 2.2 million orphans and Kenya has many more. Our experience is, we've been working since about 98. We've had 1,000 kids through, and our experience is that when you give a kid a chance in class, they will work very hard and they will have a very good future through their education. Kid who drops out becomes a problem in the community. You get the street kids, you get the sort of bums in going back into the villages. Not through their fault, but perhaps more because the community cannot cope up with them. The students have their own voluntary service group. They have constructed a house for a local AIDS widow, and they grow vegetables on a regular basis, and they supply them to the local school for the blind children to increase their nutrition. We've had a lot of success with our kids. A lot of them gone on to university. A lot of them now are professionals. Still quite a few of them are in training. We have one boy, Henry, who comes to mind, who dropped out of school for 5 years, and he's now in Gulu University on government sponsorship because he worked very, very hard. He saw that he had a future after 5 years of not being able to afford any education. We helped him with his A-level course. Now he's in Gulu University on government sponsorship. He's very much involved in Rotary, in the Interact Club and the Rotaract Club. Now he's setting up a Rotaract Club in Gulu. One of the great things of these students is they know why they are in school. We have kids who walk in between 5 and 8 kilometres a day, or maybe they might have the use of a family bicycle to come in. These kids are very serious with their education. We used to have a girl who walked 12 kilometres a day to get to her school, and that was on one meal a day because her mother was very sick with AIDS. She could no longer work. The grandmother had a little kiosk shop, and she used to provide food for the 5 members of the family, and that was one meal a day. When we were able to get the 3 kids into school, that meant that the mother had a chance to have 2 meals a day.
What are your hopes? I know the children have such big hopes and dreams, and are you optimistic from the networking and meeting of minds here in Toronto?
I am. I think we've met a lot of good people. I think we've got a lot of alternate thoughts into which areas some people can go into. Some people are very interested in our project. We've had people from all over Africa saying, can't we go and help them elsewhere? Currently, our plans are to try and, can I say, complete Lordsmead Vocational College at Injeru, near Jinja. And then the dreams are to copy the idea in different places in Uganda, possibly in Kenya, so that we can help more of these orphans, because they are such an important part of the future. A child of a wealthy parent, they have a good future. But it's very interesting at times, you get a child from a wealthy parent, the parent dies, and then the child becomes a total orphan and drops out. Because part of the African cultures, if you do too much forward planning, people believe that you're planning your own death. So this is a culture that we're trying to get the parents to think about a bit.
George Campango.
Malawi is in Africa, and as an African country, it is beset by cultural beliefs and practices. And so it is generally believed that some cultural practices do influence, do fuel HIV transmission. And so Manet Plus plays the role of advocating for the modification of some of these risky cultural practices and beliefs. And looking at the religious leaders, from the beginning of the epidemic, it has been said that religious leaders are the ones that are fueling stigma and discrimination, because they believe that people living with HIV and AIDS must have been immoral at one time or another. And that's what we've been trying to fight against, that it's not immorality. It's not a question of immorality. This is a disease like any other disease. It's an infection like any other infection. And so something has to be done about it. And it's to remind the religious leaders that they are there to advance the teachings of religion. Love is not about discrimination and stigmatization. Love, it is about working together, understanding each other's problems and how you address them.
Nelson Mandela once said, "One of the biggest challenges to combating HIV/AIDS is uprooting some ingrained traditional beliefs." According to faith-based organizations who are involved in the fight against HIV/AIDS, religious institutions represent a major resource in the effort to prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS. However, the question remains, are religious institutions on the same page in their efforts? Ron Reynolds from the African HIV Policy Network in the United Kingdom.
What we've done so far is that we've met with Christian faith leaders and communities. And you'll notice I just don't say faith leaders, I say faith communities, because it's not always just faith leaders that are responsible for stigma, but faith communities. And then we've brought together the Muslim faith leaders and communities, so imams and people from that faith as well. And we've talked about what is ongoing programs that they have in relation to HIV stigma, in relation to HIV period, what are their knowledge bases, and what are the resources that they need to help them in fighting this stigma, HIV-related stigma. And then we brought together both communities, Christian and Muslim, because we know predominantly that's where our communities, where their faith begins and where their faith lies, and had a whole discussion with African and Caribbean community-based organizations to begin to think about how can we usefully tackle HIV-related stigma. In policy terms, government in particular talk about faith and how faith is important to our communities, but they don't know how to engage faith communities in their work, and specifically in prevention.
Jesse Milan of the Constella Group, the Center for Disease Control, and the Black AIDS Institute in the U.S.
Women are truly the backbone of faith-based organizations around the world. Black, white, U.S., international, African, women are the ones who are sitting in those pews. Women are the ones who are paying their tithes and others. Women are the ones who are doing the work in churches. And I think that women have to help their own churches be accountable that they are sending the right messages about prevention and care and treatment for people with HIV/AIDS and are not silent. It is women who are bearing the brunt of caring for their sons and daughters and husbands even who have HIV/AIDS. Mm-hmm. So the impact on women as caregivers has to be assessed. And then we have to bring to the public conversation the impact HIV/AIDS has on women who feel that they have no other economic or social recourse but to be with men who are either abusing them or who are lying to them about their own sexual activities. Women who are married have no choice in their relationships but to accept the sexual advances of their husband. Mm-hmm. Women who are living in relationships with men who or the men are providing for their children may not have any option but to respond to the sexual needs of their partners, and to do so means that they have to do so in a way that the men are willing to participate in, which often means without condoms, and therefore women are not being protected. So women as caregivers, women in terms of their social and economic power, and women in terms of their own sexual health are the issues I think that really have to be addressed now more than ever about HIV/AIDS.
Much of the discussion amongst world leaders like Bill and Melinda Gates, Stephen Lewis, and Bill Clinton surrounded the need to empower women and recognize their integral role in successfully addressing this epidemic. Meanwhile, Canada's Blueprint on Women issued a report card with a D grade and demands for improvements for women. As Bill Gates said earlier in the conference, no matter who she is, where she lives, or what she does, a woman should never need her partner's permission to save her own life. Winston Husbands of the African and Caribbean Council on HIV/AIDS in Ontario, ACHO.
our women, our black women, African and Caribbean women in the diaspora, are they empowered enough, for example, to discuss or negotiate safer sex with their male partners? That's an issue. There are also issues related to safer sex among black gay men and other black men who have sex with men. Do they have sufficient knowledge and information on which to base their decisions about negotiating sex? And are they to feel empowered to be able to negotiate safer sex? Because among gay men and in MSM communities, certainly in Canada, most of the prevention efforts have not really focused on black men. So one of the issues might be a lack of information or an unwillingness to engage the information that is available because of the perception that it is not for them, that it is only for white men, that HIV maybe is only a disease of white gay men. And if we step back a bit further from those reasons, then we'll come to the other issues of the determinants of health. So here we are talking now about racism, homophobia, a lack of employment opportunities, low incomes and so on. Now, these things do not sort of cause people to become infected. What they do mean, however, is that because of low incomes, racism, marginalization, and so on, it means that large numbers of people in our communities do not have the capacity or the resources to make the decisions that would enhance life. For example, if one's immediate need is to find housing and shelter and so on, then those things get prioritized over HIV, which is something that may or may not happen in the future. So you know, there are a lot of factors, a range of factors, and so we're trying to enter sort of the issue at several levels at the same time. So ACHO has just published HIV prevention guidelines and a manual for people from Africa and the Caribbean in Canada. And it's really a resource for service providers. It can also be used by ordinary community members. But really, it's part of ACHO's effort to develop the capacity or improve the capacity of organizations and service providers to serve African and Caribbean people in more effective ways. So that was the purpose behind it. So we've spent the last 2 years working on the guidelines and the manual, and they are now available. They will be available. We will make them available to organizations throughout Canada. The manual is available in English and French. Not only are we making the manual available, but over the next several months, we are also going to be organizing workshops beginning in Ontario, so throughout Ontario first of all, to work with service providers on the issues so that they can use the manual more effectively and more creatively.
Ron Reynolds from the African HIV Policy Network in the United Kingdom.
We're developing a toolkit for faith leaders and faith communities to begin to help them to articulate and to incorporate some kind of language around HIV. We've launched a campaign called the Changing Perspectives Campaign, which is about how do we as African communities own this issue of HIV? How do we as positive people, how do we as faith leaders and faith communities, how do we as government, and how do we as the media? And I can tell you, the media, and the black media in particular, has particularly marginalized our communities by showing HIV as something that equals death, which does not necessarily translate here in the UK when people do have, in most cases, have access to treatment.
Ron, can you tell me what's your group doing to combat this negative impact that the media is having on the response to this epidemic?
In my presentation in Toronto, I showed some grave examples of how the media is responding to the epidemic, and we've got a long way to go for them to begin to talk about HIV in a different vein, to not marginalize communities, especially our communities. Mm-hmm. We've had headlines like HIV assassin. We had headlines like 1 in 1,000 migrants has HIV. And some of them are they misinform the public, they marginalize communities, and they are clearly racist. So I know people who are afraid to talk to the media and giving any kind of background information because of the links back home and links here to within their communities. People still live within their small communities, whether they're Jamaican or Nigerian or wherever. And so it's that fear of, you know, fear of so many things: violence, fear of being marginalized. I think what we find are people going outside of their communities for services because they don't want to see someone else within their communities seeing them walking into a place where they know that people go for HIV/AIDS services. As people who are migrants, or who are minorities within a larger white population, it creates a feeling of isolation.
The National Press Foundation developed pre-conference training seminars to sensitize media, historically blamed for feeding societies with subjective, even stigmatizing notions related to HIV/AIDS. Meanwhile, the Global Network of People Living with HIV/AIDS North America have launched an important initiative to fight stigma and discrimination prevalent within U.S. legislature that bans HIV-positive people from crossing any border into the United States. Malsa of the British Columbia Persons with AIDS Society.
There seems to be a growing body of anecdotal evidence that the incidence of denied entry into the U.S. and persecution and or harassment for being HIV positive is becoming more commonplace. Actual statistics are virtually impossible to obtain as such information is not adequately collected or tracked by U.S. officials and what is known is not made public. Since 1987, HIV positive foreigners are banned from entering the United States. In 1987, President Reagan and Congress added AIDS to the list of dangerous, contagious diseases for excluding persons from the United States. Senator Jesse Helms, under the Helms Amendment, added HIV to this exclusionary list. Although the HIV-positive tourist and immigration ban has been almost universally criticized, both from within and outside the U.S., the restrictions remain after almost 20 years. Due to the convoluted nature of the history of this discriminating piece of legislation, the Act of Congress is required to remove it. Over the past 20 years, such mainline organizations as the American Medical Association and the World Health Organization have opposed the rule, saying there is no good reason to bar HIV-positive persons from entering the country temporarily. Unlike infectious diseases such as tuberculosis, HIV is not spread by routine contact. There is no medical or scientific justification for this travel ban. It is largely fueled by the wealth, influence, and rhetoric of faith-based fundamentalist organizations and their supporters within the U.S., and it has become very apparent that their motives have more to do with persecuting certain social behaviors than it does with any legitimate concerns for the health and welfare of American citizens. And please understand that I'm not targeting all faith-based organizations with that statement, because there are many that are allies to the HIV/AIDS movement and work diligently in behalf of people living with HIV and AIDS. The United States is one of only a handful of countries to completely ban HIV-positive visitors, even for short-term tourist stays.
Peter Weisner of Deutsche AIDS Health.
So what should be the community response? We talk a lot about the key principles, greater involvement of people living with HIV and AIDS. I think we have to admit that these regulations are not acceptable, and if conferences like this take place in a country where those regulations exist, it should be crystal clear that a conference shouldn't take place in a country where these restrictions exist. So we have to make clear that people living with HIV make a valuable contribution to the society, and we have to fight against these negative attitudes and this exclusion of people living with HIV and AIDS. Sometimes people living with HIV and AIDS will be dismissed if they are already in the respective country. Sometimes they lose everything they have, their job, access to healthcare services, their relationships and their friends. We have information that some countries deport people living with HIV and AIDS, and we know countries where migrant workers did get put in jail for deportation after their test result was turned out to be HIV positive, and we have information that some of these workers died in jail without treatment. So what is the impact for people living with HIV and AIDS? Nobody knows the exact scale of the problem. There are no sufficient reporting systems in place. What we have are anecdotal reports. The existing laws are sometimes not implied. This depends, of course, from countries to countries. So healthcare workers or health-related questions we hear about that might be asked on entry. Do you have a transmittable disease? You can decide whether to lie or not. You can tell the truth or not. And you can, of course, apply for a waiver like in the United States if you want to go through this. A health certificate and an HIV test must be required. And people won't have access to cross the border if they don't comply to this. We call this mandatory HIV testing, and from the 104 countries we talked about, 90 of them did count on mandatory HIV testing. Tests, of course, and examinations can be enforced by crossing the border. There are countries who test at the border or shortly after by crossing the border. And there are health checks, and they can be conducted redundantly for foreigners during their stay in the country. So who implements the controls? Of course, immigration officers, and they look at the physical appearance, they check the luggage and the application forms. Of course, healthcare staff and doctors under special contract with foreign embassies for visa requirements. There are recruiting agencies searching for skilled workers in the south, and they check if the would-be worker is HIV positive or not, and if he is HIV positive, he won't get the contract. There are, of course, employers and other entities, and there are, of course, travelers. So if you talk in the airplane about your HIV status or about HIV and AIDS in particular, there is a chance that you do get deported. There is a case related to China. Last year, a Japanese traveler was deported after arrival in China the next day. So these regulations, they harm, of course, tourists and travelers, but the point I wanted to make here is that they harm, of course, people who do have to stay for a longer period abroad, and that applies for migrant workers and for students. They carry the biggest burden. The costs of the tests and certificates they have to pay by the applicants. There are, of course, less chances on the labor market for people living with HIV and AIDS. There is less community focus on this global scale. This should be changed. I mean, we talk about a lot about the situation in the United States, which is very good, but we don't talk about the global scale.
Dr. Dorothy Kleffner from the Global Network of People Living with HIV/AIDS, North America.
As the world is pushing for greater involvement of people with HIV and AIDS, that we are the ones that know best how to make plans for ourselves. These policies restrict people from participating in shaping these policies. You cannot have greater involvement of people with HIV and AIDS if people can't even get there.
Steve Garrett, the state HIV/AIDS advocate for New Mexico.
Can you tell me, what is GPA? And do you feel its principles were acknowledged at the conference?
Well, GIPA, to start with, is a greater involvement of people with AIDS. And I think it was all put together to gather the group that's necessary to make the realization that AIDS is alive and well, and that we need to, us as advocates, us as people living with AIDS, are the ones that need to stand up for and fight for not only fight for, but to educate the world about what's the reality of AIDS and that it affects all of us. And as far as what went on at the conference, I think all these conferences bring together our groups and put us in one great big pile to where we are networking together to compared to what we do when we go home. And it seems like we become fragmented when we get that little bit of distance between us. And I think now more than ever, the JIPA principles should be held to like law, and that we all need to stand together as one and unite and make this a real live issue in the face of our politicians and our public leaders. I don't see it being adhered to or understood or even recognized by the ones that are doling out the dollars to support our campaign.
Communities of people living with HIV/AIDS have demanded meaningful involvement at all levels. GIPA, or the Greater Involvement of People Living with HIV/AIDS, also known as the Nothing About Us Without Us philosophy, is one main area of focus in the global network of people living with HIV/AIDS and all their regional networks. Ron Reynolds from the African HIV Policy Network in the United Kingdom.
We have had a problem here in the UK in particular of balancing the way we talk about the HIV epidemic and who it impacts. And there, for I think two specific reasons. In the beginning, we would refer to HIV as it impacts the heterosexual communities, and disproportionately that would mean African populations. There's a debate about how do we talk about it, as in, do we talk about it as a heterosexual epidemic or do we talk about it as an African epidemic? The conflict that we have is if we talk about it as an African epidemic within developed country context, say here in the UK, which is a predominantly white population, will we be marginalizing African and stigmatizing African communities in particular? But then if we talk about it as a heterosexual epidemic, will the resources that would need to target black African populations be scattered out to a larger heterosexual population that's particularly white? And some of us, especially in policy terms, are arguing that we need to talk about it within the context of African communities because we need the resources targeting and hitting the epidemic where it's at, you know, mm-hmm. Africans. It's about having an analysis that's specific from a black, African, and or Caribbean perspective. Oftentimes, when we sit around the policy table and look at who the decision makers are, they don't actually reflect us. They don't look like us and actually have our cultural and the specific experiences. And so, as a senior policy officer for the AHPN, I come with a public health background to this work, but I also come to this work having done some work in human rights and race. When we talk about HIV, it disproportionately affects communities of color. And so we need to have a critical race analysis when we think about HIV and the services that need to stem the epidemic. HIV is a politicized issue, and it's a racialized issue, and we need to bring that analysis to the table when we talk about how do we stem the epidemic.
Dr. Helen Gale, co-chair of the International AIDS Conference and chair of the International AIDS Society.
As you know, we put out a report this Tuesday from the Global HIV/AIDS Prevention Working Group talking about the new prevention technologies that are in trials. And while I think we feel a lot of optimism about the different trials, circumcision, diaphragms, herpes treatment, oral pre-exposure prophylaxis, microbicides, and ultimately a vaccine, that we also realize that none of these are going to be 100% effective. And each of these tools will work best for a certain population. So there is, I think, what we want to make sure people realize that even with expanding the prevention options, there is no silver bullet, and we still need to have a comprehensive prevention response that includes the prevention strategies that we already know work, incorporate behavioral as well as biomedical prevention approaches, and that still has to be linked to treatment, care, and support if we're going to have the impact. I think one of the things people keep pushing is for somebody to say that there is going to be one silver bullet, and I think we have to recognize that even with these expanded options, they will have to be seen in a comprehensive way and linked to other, particularly behavioral strategies, if we're going to have the impact that we want in the long run, and that we still have to, which I think also came out loud and clear at this conference, address some of the underlying social and economic vulnerabilities that place populations at risk to begin with.
Stephen Lewis, UN Special Envoy on HIV/AIDS in Africa.
In the midst of everything else, we must continue to roll out treatment. I am worried by the new figures. There were 1,300,000 people in treatment at the end of 2005. 6 months later, there are 1,650,000 in treatment. The additional 350,000 seems a very modest increment. Treatment is keeping people alive. Treatment is bringing hope. Treatment is stimulating prevention. Treatment is meshing more and more frequently with community-based care. We cannot let the process slow. What has to happen, I think, is that we place a temporary moratorium on the endless self-indulgent proliferation of meetings, seminars, roundtables, discussion groups, task forces, and reports, documents, monographs, statistical data, and repetition, and concentrate every energy at country level. At the opening of this conference, Peter Piot talked of the next 25 years. He's right to do so. He indicated it would be a long and difficult haul. He's right again. But if the next 25 years are to take advantage of the guarded optimism of this conference, if the next 25 years are to overcome the lethargy and inertia of the last 25 years, if the next 25 years are to link inseparably poverty and disease and the Millennium Development Goals, then it has to happen in country, on the ground, organized and orchestrated by the countries themselves and the agencies on the ground, whether multilateral, bilateral, or civil society, must be held accountable. That's what's been missing. This 16th International AIDS Conference, beyond any preceding conference, has given voice to youth. But it's still a limited and marginalized voice, reflecting the hostile ambiguity of the adult world. The figures are brutal and stark. Only 50% of new infections between the ages of 15 and 24. And yet, who can deny the appalling absence of programs for and engagement of young people in the fight against the pandemic? The situation cries out for redress, and it must be redressed well beyond smarmy tokenism. Finally, in my view, as delegates doubtless know, the most vexing and intolerable dimension of the pandemic is what is happening to women. It's the one area of HIV and AIDS which leaves me feeling most helpless and most enraged. Gender inequality is driving the pandemic, and we will never subdue the gruesome force of AIDS until the rights of women become paramount in the struggle. Signs read, women's rights are human rights. That was the slogan that captured the Vienna International Conference on Human Rights in 1993. It was the slogan repeated at the Cairo Conference on Population in 1994, and yet again in Beijing in 1995. It's never been made real, And so long as men control the levers and baskets of power, it never will be. Sexual and reproductive health, social and economic independence, and even the whiff of gender equality are barely approximated. It's a ghastly, deadly business, this untrammeled oppression of women in so many countries on the planet. My closest colleagues and I have come to the conclusion that one of the ways to diminish the impact of the AIDS virus is by creating a powerful international agency for women, funded and staffed to the teeth. There must be voice and advocacy and operational capacity on the ground for 52% of the world's population. There is a UN reform panel at the moment contemplating the creation of a new entity, provided they have the courage to confront the warped and abysmal gender architecture of the United Nations. I challenge you, my fellow delegates, to enter the fray against gender inequality. There is no more honorable and productive calling. There is nothing of greater import in this world. All roads lead from women to social change, and that includes subduing the pandemic. For my own part, when I leave the post of envoy at the end of the year, I have asked that my successor be an African, but most important, an African woman. Yeah.
Tea, tea, kakarume, kakarume, ngari yungana andite. Singarambo, ngari yungana andite. Singarabune, gwane, gune, kembete. Oya, singarambo, ngari yungana andite.
Did the 16th International Conference on HIV/AIDS deliver? Hopes are indeed high, with the Gates Foundation taking a major philanthropic lead. Money is being poured into scientific developments. Winston Husbands of the African and Caribbean Council on HIV/AIDS in Ontario, ACHO.
Are you happy with the turnout at the conference?
Actually, I am very proud of the contribution that we have made to the 16th International AIDS Conference. It has been a lot of work. We partnered with the Black AIDS Institute in Los Angeles to design and deliver a stream of activities in the conference. So it has been a lot of work, but I am very proud of what we have done. I think we are making a difference. People are noticing. You can tell that by the turnout or events in the conference. The way in which people have been enthusiastically participating at our events in the conference, their attendance at our booths and networking zone and so on, it has just been great. There's a lot of enthusiasm for what we are doing. I think also on another level, we are making a difference. I think, you know, we talk about HIV in Africa and the Caribbean, and we talk about how diasporic communities are affected in North America, in Europe and so on. But, you know, we never talk about race. We never have a discussion or dialogue about race. And I think that one of the things that ACHO and the Black AIDS Institute have been able to do is to bring that discussion into the conference. And I think without us, I'm skeptical that without us being here, that dialogue on race might never have taken place. Now, it has not taken place as widely in the conference as I would like, but it has taken place because we are here and because we have brought it into the conference. And I think it is something that we have to acknowledge. We have to be able to speak about race, not only among ourselves here in North America, but, you know, in our communities and with our brothers and sisters in the Caribbean and Africa as well. And that is one important contribution that we have made and that we will carry forward in our activities to come.
George Campango of the Malawi Network for People Living with HIV/AIDS, Mane Plus.
The last thing is the children. The children of Malawi, let me refer to them as the youth of Malawi. I expect them to begin with to be present in Mexico. We didn't have any, at least not to my knowledge. We didn't have any. We would love to see them in Mexico. We would like to see leadership among the youth promoted so that we go to a level that when people see it, they will say, yes, Malawi is doing something. But as of now, as I said, if we didn't have any representation at that level, then I don't know. But we took part in the grandmother's thing. That was great. I applaud that. And I'm also looking forward by 2010 that political leadership will be as strong as we would want it to be. By 2010, I'm also looking forward to the JIPA being the JIPA that was and is meant to be. By 2010, I want to see an African leader, in the UN, taking lead in the HIV/AIDS programs.
Stephen Lewis mentioned that in the closing ceremony that by when he steps down, he's stepping down as the UN Special Envoy to Africa on HIV, and he mentioned about he had the same wish. What do you have to say about that?
I have one special name that I don't feel ashamed about mentioning. If it had to come to Malawi and this thing went behind Dr. Justin Malewezi, then I think we have missed the point. I think Malawi would qualify, and Justin Malewezi is the right person.
Stephen Lewis said he thinks it should be an African woman.
That's what he wishes. But I mean, we are also true. We are trying to empower women. But as long as it is African, well and good.
Steve Garrett, the state HIV/AIDS advocate for New Mexico.
I want the people to show us that it's time to deliver. I want time to deliver to happen yesterday, not today, not tomorrow, not 10 years from now. I want it now. Right. And, I mean, how can you fight this? I listened to many great speakers through this conference, and I think they got off on the wrong foot right off the start by telling a number of us that are old-time activists and that work in this field for many years. I mean, it was real depressing to hear that we needed to plan for 25 years, the next 25 years. Mm-hmm. Most of us have already reached that age to where we don't have 25 more years.
Right.
And we're working for our younger generation. And as we go through our lives and we work in doing our advocacy work in our own communities, that's what we can't strive to complete enough, is to mobilize the younger crowd, because we are getting older, and this is the way the world is looking at this, is this will go on. And it's already, as Stephen Lewis and I believe Bill Gates and Bill Clinton put it, this got a little out of hand. Way out of hand. Mm-hmm. And we're a little late trying to jump in here and slow this down. It would cost way too much money to be able to, nobody's going to put that kind of money up to be able to supply medications to everybody by 2010. I just don't see it. I'm real optimistic.
Jesse Milan of the Constella Group, the Center for Disease Control, and the Black AIDS Institute in the U.S.
Jesse, what did you glean from the conference? Did you take away with you any positive reactions that you may have?
Well, much was positive. You know, this conference in 2006 was about recognizing that HIV/AIDS has existed in this world for 25 years, to recognize again how many lives we've lost, but to take a picture, a snapshot of after 25 years, we still have 40 million people infected, and to look forward. What do we have to look forward to? New treatment advances, more prevention options for women that are coming forth, more advances in terms of the discourse on stigma, discrimination, the discourse around intravenous drug use, the discourse around human sexuality, and most importantly, the discourse around how we expound on our capacity to care and love others who are different from us. That's what we have to look forward to. That's what's positive coming out of this conference, is that we reaffirmed and recommitted to taking this for the long haul and to advancing issues of prevention, treatment, and care as quickly as we can so that we have a resolution that there's no more AIDS in this world.
Giving youth a bigger voice and attending to the important issues of access, human rights, JIPA, were certainly delivered. But we, the world, need to just keep the momentum going until we realize success. For the completed archived reports of the 16th International AIDS Conference, or to get contact information on any organization mentioned in this documentary, go to www.aids2006.org. That's www.aids2006.org. For more information on the TOFTA Educational Trust and to sponsor a student in Uganda, go to www.lordsmead.org. That's www.lordsmead.org.
Dispatches from the 16th International AIDS Conference, a CKUT 90.3 FM production, with reporting by Janice Dale and production by Shiraz Janjua.
Do you get riled up by mainstream media? Does the right wing make you want to raise a ruckus? Then Rabble is the place for you. Rabble.ca and the Rabble Podcast Network are launching our yearly membership campaign. We need your support to make sure that we can keep raising a ruckus with our independent news and podcasts. Go to Rabble.ca to find out what rewards are in store for new members. We've got DVDs, books, magazine subscriptions, and more fun giveaways to thank you for supporting Canada's most rabble-rousing independent news site, rabble.ca.